You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2005, Naveen Ismail was accused of being an unfit mother, and her son was removed from her custody by the state of California. In an article called "Where Is Your Mother? A Woman's Fight to Keep Her Child," Rachel Aviv, a staff writer for The New Yorker, examines the case, the social services agency's approach to negligence, and recounts the years that Ms. Ismail worked to regain custody of her son. It appeared in the December 2nd issue of The New Yorker, and I'm very pleased to welcome Rachel Aviv to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
What first brought your attention to this case?
Actually, I had written an article last year about homeless youth in New York City, and one of the things I was struck by was how many of these kids had grown up in foster care, and how many of them, after having aged out of the foster care system, then reunited with their biological families. And I began to wonder why, if mother and child were both so eager to reunite, why had they been separated in the first place?
Well, what happened on the day that Naveen left her son, the boy you call Adam, in your piece, home alone? How old was he?
He was 3 years old, and in the morning, she left him in his crib with a bag of crackers and a computer game and left for work, and he began calling Mama help. And eventually a neighbor heard, and she called the police. And the police came, and there was no one at home. And they asked him where his mother was, and he didn't know. And so he was taken into protective custody.
And she didn't learn about it until she came home from work many hours later.
Right.
Is it against the law to leave a three-year-old alone for all those?
It actually is. She was actually arrested for a child endangerment.
Well, what's her background?
She had Adam when she was 35. She was a single mother. Adam's father was not interested at all in playing a role in his life. And she came from...
And his family as well? I mean, she couldn't have called her mother-in-law and said,
I have an emergency here. It was a very brief relationship. I mean, the relationship was over by the time she was a few weeks pregnant. And she comes from, her family is from Egypt, she's Muslim, and she was facing a lot of the problems that most single mothers face, except that she had no family in the United States and a very limited support network.
Well, what was her defense for leaving Adam home alone? She must have known that it would be considered a crime. You just don't leave a three-year-old home alone for all those hours.
I mean, the way that she describes it is that she had just gone back to work full time. She became increasingly overwhelmed. All she thought about was getting the food on the table, going to work, making sure she didn't get fired. And she just started entering this survival mode and reached a breaking point where she really, as she puts it, she just wasn't thinking.
She was seen by a psychologist. Was there a diagnosis?
Not really. They assumed, I think the social workers assumed, that she would have a mental illness. And there was no major mental disorder. All the psychologist noted was that she was someone who was prone to be solitary and somewhat defensive.
Mysterious and vague about her past.
Mm-hmm.
So did that affect the case?
I think it did, because the social worker noted that she was secretive, that when asked about her background, she said, "I'm from the Middle East," and she didn't elaborate. And it seemed as if something dark and dirty was going on behind the scenes, and she wasn't elucidating it for anyone, so they could only suspect the worst.
Naveen claimed her cultural background and lack of likability alienated the social workers. You met her. What did you think of her?
You know, she is a shy person, and actually she's a little bit, I don't know that you would meet her and you'd necessarily think she was odd, but she responds she's very sensitive to intrusions on her privacy. So I think in a way what the social workers were doing activated her neuroses about keeping everything in her life under her own control and private.
At the same time, she must have been aware of the fact she had done something wrong and she would have to try to please the authorities.
I think it probably took her too long to realize that. For a while, she was very resistant. She thought she could convince them that this was just one mistake and that she was a good mother. And it took her a long time to realize that what she really needed to do was just comply with what they were telling her to do.
And she had 1 year to prove that she was a fit parent. What was she required to do?
So she was required to see a psychologist, which she did. She was required to attend parenting classes. And one of the issues that came up in the parenting classes was she felt that she was being taught a particular cultural model for parenting. She said she had grown up in a home that was very permissive. There wasn't much discipline. And she kept being told to institute boundaries and structures and limits. And as she put it, she felt she was being told to parent American style.
Where was Adam during this time?
He was immediately removed. First, he was placed in a home for abused and neglected children. Then he was placed in another home with five other foster children. And then he was placed in a third home with parents who were foster adopt parents, meaning they were prepared to adopt him if his mother wasn't able to regain custody.
Was she able to see him often?
She saw him twice a week for an hour and a half at a time at the office of the social service agency. And during this time, there would be one to two social workers documenting everything that passed between her and Adam, how she said hello, what kind of sweater she wore, how many times she went to the bathroom, whether Adam reciprocated her kisses. And all of these notes were then compiled and used as evidence at the court hearings to determine what kind of mother she was.
My guest is Rachel Aviv of The New Yorker. Her article, "Where Is Your Mother? A Woman's Fight to Keep Her Child," was in the December 2nd issue of the magazine. How is neglect defined by social services?
I mean, it actually changes. The guidelines vary from state to state and from county to county, but it is broad enough that it can be difficult to distinguish signs of neglect from signs of poverty or from a different culture's approach to child rearing.
Well, the director of the Orange County Social Services says the most common causes of negligence are domestic violence, mental illness, substance abuse. She wasn't accused of any of those things.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's why the social workers were so convinced that she had to have some sort of mental illness.
Orange County Social Services removes roughly 1,200 children from their homes every year, many due to parents' negligence. How does that compare nationwide?
It actually varies so much from county to county. I'm not even sure what the statistics are for each county.
I'm just wondering whether they are doing it a bit more than some people. You quote Orange County's elected supervisor Todd Spitzer as saying that social services err on the side of overreaction because the alternative could be devastating.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this case was an overreaction?
In my mind, the initial thing that she did to leave her son alone was extremely grave, and I think she recognized that. But from that point on, she did everything she possibly could to get him back. And so I think that there should be a way in which parents can recover from one awful mistake.
Did you talk to the caseworkers and suggest that to them?
One of the complications in writing about child welfare cases is that all of the court records and all of the social records are sealed. The only reason that I had access to them is because they were leaked. And that meant that none of the social workers were able to speak to me. And I think that they were very frustrated. They didn't even want to know what case I was writing about because it was illegal for them to comment on it.
You write that once Naveen was under increased scrutiny of social services, the bar for being a good enough parent seemed to rise.
Mm-hmm. You can see that the things that they are documenting in terms of what the flaws she has made become increasingly nitpicky over time. She lets her son swing a golf club too close to other people, or she doesn't notice that he shouldn't have a tuna fish sandwich while he's bowling. I mean, these are the kinds of things that you see people do on the subway.
A tuna fish sandwich when you're bowling?
You see people do these kinds of things on the subway, and maybe they're not great things to do, but they don't constitute grounds to take a child away.
At the final custody hearing in 2008, her parental rights would be terminated unless she met requirements for a parental benefit exception. What does that mean?
That means she needs to prove that her bond with her son is so strong that it outweighs the benefit of him staying in a permanent home and keeping those attachments.
Well, he had been in foster care for how long at that point?
More than 2 years.
The bond probably had been weakened. It would have been weakened for any child.
Right. I mean, that's one of the sad things is reading these social workers' notes, which are almost written like in a novelistic fashion. They're extremely detailed, and you can see the way in which that bond is weakening, and Adam is very confused, and he's saying, are you tired, or what's wrong, Mom? And he's getting angry, and you can see the way that that process itself puts so much strain on the relationship.
Was he, did he take the stand at the hearing?
At the final hearing, he did, and he was repeatedly asked which house he would rather be at, with the potential adoptive family or with his biological mother, and he kind of tried to skirt the question for a while, and eventually he was asked if he wanted to leave the adoptive family, and he said no, and he was asked if he wanted to see his biological mother, and he said yes, yes, yes. So he never really gave a clear answer.
But the final verdict was he was going to stay with the adoptive foster family.
Right.
Once her parental rights were terminated, what was her role in her son's life?
It was extinguished, essentially. She was not allowed to see her son. She requested visitation rights, and she became very active. She wrote her own appeals and her own writs of habeas corpus, and she appealed to the Supreme Court. Nothing worked. And then
the U.S. Supreme Court.
The U.S. Supreme Court.
And they just didn't want to hear the case?
No. And when that ended, she started looking for other options, other ways of keeping her son within reach. And she started looking for incriminating information about the adoptive family, hoping that she could thwart that process.
So she hired a private investigator?
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there are two different versions of the story, but according to her, she wanted to speak to the detective to see if he could find any incriminating details about the adoptive family that would make them unfit parents. According to the detective, they also discussed a plan B, which would be to kidnap her son and go to a new country.
So she wound up being arrested for that?
Mm-hmm. Arrested for attempted kidnapping and then acquitted.
But she did spend 3 months in jail, didn't mm-hmm. she, before the trial?
Right.
I'm assuming that also affects any attempt she might make to get her son back.
Yeah, at this point, it doesn't seem, although I think she still has faith that she will see him, it doesn't seem like there's any mechanism within the legal system by which she would see him.
Now, you mentioned that notes were leaked. Mm-hmm. You probably can't reveal too much about that.
Mm-hmm.
But would that be typical, or was it because somebody was concerned about this case?
I do think that in these cases, the notes pass through so many hands that it's not atypical for the notes to get out. But I do think that the fact that it's all sealed does give a skewed impression in terms of the media coverage that there is about the child welfare system. I mean, so many of the articles about the child welfare system are written about these worst case scenarios where a child who is known to the system dies in a horrific fashion. And those articles can be very scary for the agencies, and it will make them be more inclined to err on the side of caution.
And caseworkers get fired.
Their reputation ruins their reputation.
After the criminal case, Naveen was working on a civil rights suit against the social services agency. What was her argument?
Her argument was essentially that American law gives wide discretion to parents to raise their children the way that they want to raise their children, that is an important freedom, and that the social workers had gone beyond protecting Adam's safety to kind of deciding that she had not internalized their instructions about what it means to be a good parent, that they were kind of asserting their own cultural values.
My guest is Rachel Aviv, whose article in The New Yorker, The Child Challenge, Who Decides If a Parent is Good Enough, was in the December 2nd issue of the magazine. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Rachel Aviv, whose article, Where is Your Mother? A Woman's Fight to Keep Her Child, was in the December 2nd issue of The New Yorker. So after that that happened, let's talk a bit about the way the laws have been written. You quote Barbara Nelson, former dean of UCLA, who wrote about the increasing willingness of politicians to fund child welfare legislation. When did that occur?
There was a philosophical shift in the 70s, which then accelerated in the 90s. And in the first half of the century, the primary purpose of the child welfare system was to keep families intact. And they were offered various services like childcare and financial benefits. And that began to change in the 60s when pediatricians and radiologists discovered that children had these mysterious bone fractures. And it was eventually determined that this was because their parents were abusing them. And this was called the battered child syndrome. And that became a kind of media phenomenon. And
then there were some headline cases where children died as a result of abuse of one sort or another.
Right. And states were very concerned by this. And all of the states passed mandatory reporting laws so that medical professionals, police officers, teachers, all are required to report when they see a children who shows possible signs of abuse or neglect. And soon the child welfare system was overwhelmed by these allegations of mistreatment, and they were tasked with investigating almost 2 million of these allegations a year.
Did this also become a federal situation, the Adoption and Safe Families Act of 1997?
Right. In 1997, there was a concern that people had been the children were staying too long in foster care. In the 90s, because of the AIDS epidemic and the crack epidemic, there was a lot more children than ever before in foster care, and they were staying there for a long
time. Children were being taken out of the homes of families where parents were HIV positive or where they had been known to abuse drugs.
Right. And instead of the parents getting their children back, the children were just languishing in foster care.
Did they ever allow for rehabilitation?
They did. I mean, at this time, the criticism was that the system was giving too much time to parents, and parents were trying and failing, and children were spending their entire lives in this impersonal system without ever forming attachments. So the Adoption and Safe Families Act was designed to fix that problem by placing strict limits on how long parents had to prove their competence, and it also valued adoptions more. It tried to encourage adoptions by giving financial incentives to counties that increase their numbers of adoption.
One of the people you quote is Loyola University law professor Sacha Coupe. What's her view of the effectiveness of the Adoption and Safe Families Act?
She believes that it kind of presents this fairy tale vision that you can just wipe the slate clean, take a child away from his biological family, put him in with a new, better family, and it's happily ever after. And basically she thinks that that solution is a way of avoiding the more complicated problem, the root causes of abuse and neglect, which require a lot more probably resources and thinking about how to prevent these problems from happening in the first place.
Well, is there a better course? We then hear about abuses within the foster care system and people who abuse their foster children or have a lot of them so that they can make some money. Adopted children are sometimes also become headline stories. It seems to me that this is an almost impossible situation to work out.
Well, I think that there could be a lot more emphasis on in-home services. These families I think Naveen, the irony of her case is that I think she would be the first to acknowledge that she needed some kind of intervention, and I think she would have done really well if someone had come, she had seen a psychologist just as she did, and if maybe she had gotten help with childcare, and maybe she had taken these parenting classes, but Adam had stayed at home with her, and then that would avoid the second trauma for children, which is not just the trauma of being abused or neglected, but of being yanked out of their families and sent to a new family.
Well, were there any child care services in the area? Could she have just brought him to some place?
She should have, yes.
But she didn't.
Right.
In just 5 years after the law was passed in 1997, adoptions were up 42% because states were rewarded for the number of adoptions. Do you think Adam would have been put up for adoption before that law was passed?
I mean, my guess is not. I think that law made it shifted the emphasis so that it was a much speedier process. I think Naveen really got herself together after a few months, and at that point it was almost too late.
Well, it's now been how long since Adam, or that's the name you have given him,
pseudonym,
was adopted?
It has been about 7 years.
How's he doing?
I was never able to speak to him, but the last time that the court records describe how he's doing, he seemed to be doing very well, a smart, well-adjusted kid.
And what about Naveen? How's she doing?
She recently had another baby, a girl who's very healthy, and I think Naveen is more cognizant this time of her limits and has been working part-time, and her child is in daycare, and I think she still does believe that she will reunite with her son.
Well, she's had another child, so have social services gotten involved or continue to be involved in her life?
No, she now lives in another county, and she has not had any involvement with social services.
Has anybody offered suggestions for reforming the policies that are now in place?
I think there's a consensus that it would be really helpful if, instead of the social services agencies approaching families as kind of quasi-police bodies and investigating, they could come forward in a more collaborative role. And I think that generally there's some agreement that more in-home services would be needed, and that there are a lot of cases where that only the most drastic cases should the child be removed from home, and that there are that these in-between cases, maybe more could be done to preserve the family.
Well, you would think that somebody would have noticed how hard Naveen fought to get her child back, and at least have come up with some kind of a plan for her to be able to remain in contact with him. Is there a fear that she might try to kidnap him?
I think at this point, after that kidnapping trial, she has been, she's just, the adoptive family has complete control. They have no reason to, she has no legal rights to her child, so it's entirely their decision, and they don't feel comfortable anymore.
I assume that when Adam becomes an adult, he will then be able to reconnect with her if he wishes.
If he wants, right.
Rachel Aviv's article, Where is Your Mother? A Woman's Fight to Keep Her Child, was in the December 2nd issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.